She's Tori.
And he's Nick.
And this is I Want to Rewatch,
an X-Files adjacent podcast.
In search of
life after death.
This episode's story is by Charles Panotti. The narration was written by Deborah Bloom and produced by Deborah Bloom. It is directed by H.G. Stark. It's edited by Cliff Holscher with assistance by John Dabney. The series is hosted and narrated by Leonard Nimoy and originally aired on Wednesday, June 29th, 1977.
Yay!
We see nurses running down a hallway and an announcement over the speaker that says, "Kathleen, code blue." And a patient is wheeled down the hall as someone gives chest compressions. And then we see a defibrillator coming in with them into the room. And then we see doctors working on them. And then we get narration.
Code blue, an emergency call used in hospitals all over the country. Code blue alerts a special team of doctors and nurses that a patient has died. A resuscitation attempt will be made. If it is successful, the patient is brought back to life. In some cases, they have amazing stories to tell about what it is like on the other side.
Whoa. And then it's the opening credits.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of thought he was going to give us, like, and if it's successful, they're brought back to life. And if not, they die.
And if not,
Yeah, and then we come back, you know, because we get that narration in the middle, and we get some screen on the text that says, "Some of the hospital sequences in this program are recreations of real events," which makes me think that maybe not all of the hospital sequences are recreations. That's what this would imply.
And it kind of feels like they're pretty generic circumstances anyway. So, I mean, there are a couple specific cases we hear about, but it just, anyway, it's kind of a weird little warning.
Yeah. And we get our little mid-narration.
What is it like to die? In search of examined.
He'd be like, "We'll find out."
It's just so melodramatic. Holy shit. Okay, I can do this.
In search of life after death. Dun, 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 dun. We get the rest of our opening credits, and then we get our theory and conjecture caveat. So I have to say, the dude doing the CPR when they're rolling the patient in is like worse than Scully at it. But he did try longer, but he's kind of like, it's like he's just touching the dude, like, "Ooh, here."
Well, it's a reenactment.
I guess we'll try and make it look real, for God's sakes. He does a little better later because we're going to continue. It's going to be the same people. He's doing it crazy slow, but at least he's actually doing like some compression.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So we open the episode and we learn that Dr. Thomas Rockwell is on intimate terms with death.
He is Dr. Death.
He's not Dr. Death. There's a whole podcast called Dr. Death about, oh my God, I can't remember the guy's name.
I've listened to that podcast. Yeah,
it was pretty good. Rockwell is one of many doctors caught in the debate over the medical definition of death. Rockwell says that we're all composed of billions of cells and they depend on each other for survival, but each has a lifespan of its own. In the past, death was defined as the point at which the heart stops. But we've learned that some cells in the body can live on after the heart stops beating. So we've redefined death as the death of cells in the brain, and it can be difficult to tell when it's occurred. The change of the medical definition of death has startling implications for everyone.
This may be one of the things why they use some of these earthy creations. Because I really hope they were using a cadaver for this reenactment, because like the dude is doing compressions like really slow, but he actually doing them. Uh-huh. And you can like totally injure people doing that. So also, if it's not a cadaver, that guy deserves a special extra super Emmy for like the best breath holding by an actor playing a dead person ever.
Yeah.
He does not breathe. And then also, I'm pretty sure that was a real defibrillation they gave the body. It looked pretty real the way the body jumped.
It did. So,
Then makes me wonder, though, because he had a pretty identifiable tattoo on his arm. So I really hope like his family gave permission to use the body, or it was like, you know, like a donation body or something, because it would be really sucky if they were like, you know, their neighbors are like, hey, I saw Jim on TV, you know. That would be awful to find out.
Yeah, so. Probably gave permission. I mean, a lot of people, yeah.
Yeah, but I think that was probably a already dead body, I'm hoping, because otherwise, whew.
Yeah, not good. That stuff breaks ribs when they do it. I mean, it's hardcore, yeah. So.
Yeah, and like I said, he was really compressing when in that part. He was still doing it super slow. The dude would die if he was alive, because he was doing it way too slow. But he was really pressing. So, yeah.
So then Nimoy asks what it's like to die. Thanks to advances in medical science, there are a few among us who claim to know what death is. Ooh. People who have technically crossed the line between life and death. Those accounts are remarkably similar in that it seems the experience was not unpleasant at all. And that's probably because of endorphins. Although actually there's an article we'll talk about at the end of this that talks about how there are people who have really unpleasant near-death experiences, and those ones really never get repeated because people don't want to talk about the ones that are like really where traumatic demons or horrific. Are like
attacking
or...
you and shit. Yeah, some of them have like ones where like demons are like getting them and shit. Yeah, I've heard those stories.
So it's not that they're all pleasant. It's just the pleasant ones are the ones that the media loves to tote out and be like, hey, check out this story. Yeah.
And we're jumping ahead a little bit, but the whole like, you know, a long tunnel and the bright light, that's actually just because of the way your brain works when like it's deprived of oxygen and that kind of stuff. So,
Nimoy relays the account of one such person who crashed their car. The person felt like they were tumbling through a long tunnel and then suddenly found themselves floating over the scene of the accident. Another describes their experience of almost drowning as a child. And this is a quote. Suddenly, I was engulfed in blackness. I could hear a soft, vibrating sound in my ear like wind chimes. And then I was above my body, watching them pull me out of the water and pound on my back.
And this reenactment is horrifying. Oh
yeah,
my
it's
God.
Pretty freaky.
The dude is like, there's some dude like pressing on the, like literally like kind of like pounding on the kid's back. And then he grabs him by the hair and like wrenches his head up and looks at him in the face and then boom, slams it back on the cement. And I was like, oh my God, holy shit. Like one, you probably just broke that kid's neck. I don't know. Yeah, that was probably like a live child, I imagine. But I could be wrong. Maybe they found a dead kid to put in some swim trunks. I don't know. But that was just like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's pretty hardcore. Another, who had a heart attack, collapsed and felt themselves go out of their body. The next thing they knew, they were in a rolling field too beautiful to describe and overcome with a feeling of peace and tranquility.
Yeah, we get footage of the field, but I mean, we try to describe it, but too beautiful.
Yeah, too pretty. And then we meet Catherine Hayward, who tells us that in 1970, she was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, and due to being pregnant, she couldn't have any of the available treatments. In June of 1973, she knew she was dying, and she made arrangements for her kids, and then she entered the hospital with no expectation of leaving. She was only 27. Her friend Anne, who took her to the hospital, relays how she was taken into the ER and then admitted to the coronary care unit. Howard says she was lying on her side and she was looking at the heart monitor, and then suddenly the line went straight across. And then she was standing over her body, watching the nurse adjust the wires. She kept wanting to tap on the nurse's shoulder and tell her that she wasn't in there. And then she saw this group of nurses and doctors rush in. And she turned and she stepped into a tunnel. She started moving upward and she felt exhilarated. At the end of a tunnel was a light so bright she thought it would hurt her eyes. And then she saw a figure 50 feet ahead of her and she knew it was God. She begged God not to make her go back, to let her stay. Finally, he just took her and firmly but gently pushed her away and told her she had to go back. God, this...
No, 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 you're not.
This is serious. No, 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 just... This is somebody's very serious experience of their meeting God, and you were laughing about it, sir.
Because God was like, Or she was like, please, God, let me stay. And he's like, nah, pushing her away.
He told because he told her she had to go back. There was a task she had to do for him.
And then he walked away.
He just walks away, leaves her. It's great. And she was furious. She talks about how she was really angry. And as she came to, she was in pain. And she was fighting against coming back. Doctors say the pain was caused because they were mistakenly pumping oxygen into her stomach instead of her lungs. But she insists it's because she knew she didn't belong there.
She was resurrected by malpractice. How could you sue? What would be your claim? They brought me back to life by doing bad medicine. Like, what would you think? Could you really? I don't know.
That'd be a rough one.
That'd be a rough case. Because, like, if they did everything right, you might have died. So, yeah.
Yeah. But then the monitor flatlined again. Maybe God changed his mind. And they put an oxygen mask. It's terrible. All right. They put an oxygen mask on her and wheeled her into the ICU. She left her body again and went immediately into the light and into God's presence. And he took her into his arms and very gently said, do you understand? She said she did. And then she came back into her body with the easiest breath. It's a little passive aggressive to like push her back into her body. And then she's like upset about it. And he's like, no, come back. We're not leaving things like that. Gives her like a, anyway, the whole thing is weird.
Well, it's not like he told her to come back, let me settle things. It's like she like basically like ran back astrally, right? She's like, I'm heading to that light. Do-do-do-do-do. And then he's like, hey, you understand? And then she's like, yes. And like, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So she ended up leaving the hospital and she hasn't been back. 3 years later, her physician reports that she has no trace of Hodgkin's disease.
Yeah, I don't know about Catherine. There's just a lot of weirdness in her story. Also, then they say, like, when they're talking about, like, how it's been 3 years and she hasn't had any, you know, because Hodgkin's is actually, it's cancer, it's lymphoma. It's not called Hodgkin's disease anymore. It's Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Uh-huh.
But then they talk about how, like, now she's remarried and started a new life. And I'm like, what the like, there are no kids anywhere. We never see kids.
Yeah.
Like, she had kids and she was pregnant and apparently gave birth to a kid because then 3 years later is when she died. There are no kids. She's got a kitten. There's no kids. Like, did the other husband leave because she was dying? And then, like, what did she do with the kids? I don't know.
Well, she made arrangements for them before she went to
the I guess. She was like, you signed that. I don't want them back. I'm going to God here. You just keep them. Push them away. Yeah. There's one thing I learned from God. It's like, just away.
Push things away from you. That is my takeaway. She's going to start a new religion.
Yeah,
she'll start a little cult in like California and everyone will dress like hippies and just push people away. You gotta
push away the things that don't belong. Do you understand? Oh, man.
Then we meet Dr. Charles Garfield, and he's been involved with several hundred people who have died in the past few years. He's a psychiatrist at the University of California Cancer Research Institute.
That's my first grade photo. I am wearing a shirt that looks exactly like Dr. Charles Garfield's shirt.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I don't know about the cuffs, because the design is also on the cuffs. The design around like the yoke of the shirt is also on the cuffs. I don't know if mine had, I don't think mine had it on the cuffs, but my school photo wouldn't show the cuffs, so I couldn't.
Right.
But yeah. I guess that'd be about the right time, too.
Yeah, 77.
76, 77, so first grade for me would have been, yeah.
Nice.
That was stylish.
Years ago, Garfield was teaching a class at UC Berkeley called The Psychology of Death. He got a letter from Shelley Rudderman in which he described his experience 12 years earlier about dealing with advanced lung cancer. The letter and their later conversations really had an impact on Garfield. Shelley Rudderman's experience with death began in 1960 and had a profound effect on his life. And I'm just not realizing how that sounds, because obviously death is going to have a profound effect on your life. That's okay, though. So Rudderman now counsels cancer patients like Micah Friedman. So there's like this kid that he's talking to in the episode. I'm assuming that's Micah. He believes the power of the mind can reinforce medical treatment, and thus far, the results have been positive. Ruderman's original diagnosis gave him 2 years to live, which seemed unbelievable to him at the time. Ruderman told his doctor that he wasn't going to die, and his doctor's task was to help him not die. Garfield says in his experience, about 15% of the people he works with have what he calls a death-accepting attitude. Many others are angry and furious, which is, I feel like, very understandable. So, it's kind of interesting. Ruderman survived an 8-hour surgery, and when he came out of that, he felt physically violated. 17 days after, the surgeon told him there was supposedly some mechanical problem in his body they'd have to correct, but supposedly it was this minor correction, so they wouldn't have to put him under.
Yeah, but they said it was a valve, and I am sorry. If you are doing anything that involves a valve, you are giving me some fucking anesthesia. Screw you.
Like, yeah.
Because I can only think of one thing that has valves, and that is my heart. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. We don't know what his cancer was. We just know it was cancer. Mm-hmm. We don't know what kind of surgery he had. But if the doctor said they have to work on a valve, I'm thinking you need to give me some anesthesia. Screw you.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So Ruderman was uncomfortable, especially as it was a teaching hospital. So lots of people were watching the procedure. So he tried to imagine a board to keep everyone from seeing him. And then suddenly he was up at the ceiling watching the surgery and watching the people watching him. But it was fuzzy around his body and he couldn't actually see the wound or what they were doing at all. It just got like fuzzier and fuzzier the closer you got to the surgery.
Yeah, he was probably hallucinating from shock because they didn't give him any freaking anesthesia.
Well, they must have given him something, even if he wasn't under. Like, they must have given him some kind of painkiller.
I mean, maybe a local. I don't know.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah. It still makes me wonder, like, what they were doing. Like, did he have rectal cancer? Did he have prostate cancer? We don't know what kind of cancer he had. So, I mean, maybe, I mean, the word valve makes me think heart, which.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like that would cancer. Be heart surgery, because I don't think they would keep you awake for heart surgery.
No, because they usually have to open your chest. So that would be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I mean, this is him saying what the doctor said. So.
Yeah. Who knows if the word valve was even a word that they used.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they meant sphincter. Maybe they meant, you know, anything. So we don't know. So.
So every 15 minutes, the surgeon would ask how he was doing. And he'd go back into his body to answer and then fly back out. And then he realized it was up to him whether he lived or died. Garfield tells us that Ruderman credits himself and his will to live for his newborn baby as the key to his survival. And then we see Ruderman leading Micah in this guided meditation where he imagines his blood cells squirt gunning his cancer cells and making them shrink.
Yeah, he also tells us a story about how, like, his wife smuggled their child into the hospital, like, in a grocery bag because they weren't allowed to have babies in his hospital room.
Oh, the 6-month old. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and the more I think about it, I'm wondering if he did have prostate cancer, because that is a common, along with like erectile dysfunction, that is a common side effect from having that, is that you have like urinary issues where you can't control yourself. And so that may have been part of it. That also may have been one of the reasons why maybe he felt violated after the surgery, too, just because you're messing with, like, you know, manhood kind of stuff.
Well, so, maybe.
I mean, we don't know. We never find out. We don't get details, which may be another reason why that might be the case, because they don't give us details. And so you wouldn't want to talk about that on TV. So we don't know. But that does seem. I'm just trying to make his story make sense. And like, so I'm thinking about things that would possibly make that make sense, and why maybe you wouldn't need to be put completely under for certain kinds of surgery that would have been a byproduct of cancer surgery. So I'm thinking, probably I'm willing to bet it probably was like prostate cancer or something. So
So Ruderman says whether he lived or died did not depend on the rules doctors understand, and now he believes there is life after death.
And I don't know. I'm trying to make his story makes sense to me, but I don't his entire story, I don't see where it's a life after death story. It's an out of body experience story.
Yes.
But it doesn't seem like he, unless he supposedly died on the operating table, which doesn't sound like that's what happened. So
sure. I think that his takeaway was like, I'm here and I can leave my body behind. So it's up to me whether I live or die, not up to these doctors. It doesn't matter what they do. it matters what I choose to do. And so that was like his takeaway. And so he's assuming that means because he was out of his body, he has a non-corporeal form that must then continue to exist without his body in some form of afterlife.
Or he just wasn't away from it long enough for it to dissipate.
Yeah, that too. Or it didn't really happen and it was just a hallucination.
Because he didn't get any fucking anesthesia. But
yeah. Oh, these lovely doctors. Anyway. Garfield believes there is something else after death, but if you ask him what he knows for sure, he's in the same position as the rest of the human race. Because then he doesn't know.
Yeah.
Rudderman says the out-of-body experience was the key thing that changed his worldview, because if your consciousness can be outside your body, there is something that transcends life.
Whoa.
Yeah, so like I just said, that's his conclusion from all this.
Yeah.
And then we come back to Leonard Nimoy and we get the closing narration.
Ooh.
Independent accounts of the out-of-body experience are remarkably similar. What they tell us about the nature of human consciousness may have great significance. The fact that the experience cannot be adequately explained by science has led many to question the finality of death. Is there life after death? Today, there are many who've gone over the brink and returned to tell us about it. They do not offer proof of life after death, but their reports give us a new perspective on the possibility that death is not an ending, but a beginning. And then that's it. That's the episode. Woo! Yep.
Dun, 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 dun. Yep, closing credits.
Mm-hmm.
I was so... I have a lot of complaints about this episode, but one of the things I was surprised at is that we do not meet any of the people who were in learning ESP, despite a large number of them having been out of body experience and life after death proponents and researchers. And like Robert Monroe, out of body dude. We had Carlos Osis, who we actually didn't meet, but we saw, who was a near death experience guy. We had Dr. Charles Tart, who also was big into OBEs. Like, none of them do it. And then I guess there is probably an overlap between OBEs and, I couldn't remember what the acronym was for like life after death stuff. It's actually NDE for near death experience.
Right, near death experience.
But I went ahead and made them LADEs, L-A-D-E's for life after death experiences. But I, like they are separate. I imagine it's one of those things like all near death experiences are OBEs, but not all OBEs are near death experiences kind of thing. Like they overlap, but they're not, you know, either or kind of thing. And I guess remote viewing can kind of be considered an OBE. I mean, there are some aspects of remote viewing where people actually talk about like they're like above and moving. So that's kind of almost like astral projection, astral viewing kind of thing. We could have thrown in Alex Tanos too, because he was a remote viewer and he was working with Carlos Osis, the Latvian born parapsychologist who specialized in exploring deathbed phenomena and life after death. I mean, we didn't meet any of those people. We didn't talk to any of them. And like, we could have. They were on the other episode.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't want to film with In Search Of again.
I don't even know that they filmed with In Search Of, honestly. I think a lot of that might have been...
just like stock footage, yeah.
Yeah.
That might be why we didn't see them.
Possibly. And then the second... I don't know. The whole, like, it's life after death. We really didn't talk about life after death at all. The second half of the episode was basically all, like, mind-body stuff, like, I'm going to say that I can heal myself and so I'm going to heal myself and then like out-of-body experience stuff. It didn't really have anything to do with life after death experiences. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I think this is probably the worst In Search Of episode I've seen so far.
I don't know if it's the worst, but it's definitely not one of the good ones.
Well, the reenactments were bad, but they weren't like funny bad. They were just bad.
Yeah.
The narration was pretty weak. Both the opening and closing narration, not good. Not even like over the top entertaining. It was just kind of like, meh. The people they interviewed were kind of boring and lackluster. And then Kids With Cancer is just depressing. Like,
yeah.
Like Kids With Cancer is like the proof that there is no God, in my opinion. Because if there is a God, then he can go fuck himself because he's a cruel God unworthy of worship. Because like Kids With Cancer is like one of the worst things.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Anyway. So, of course, I always do the research. I couldn't find anything on this Dr. Thomas Rockwell. There is a Dr. Thomas Rockwell who is a geologist at San Diego State University, but he's too young. And then I also found a Thomas Hugh Rockwell, PhD, who passed away peacefully on Christmas morning in 2015 at the age of 86 in Columbus, Ohio, surrounded by his children and his wife of 61 years, Elizabeth. He was professor emeritus at the Ohio State University in the field of human factors engineering, and he pioneered many advances in automotive safety and design. He served in the Catholic Church as an Eucharistic minister, comforting and caring for the sick and dying. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the Dr. Thomas H. Rockwell Endowment Fund at Ohio State University. He isn't the Dr. Rockwell that was in this episode, but he sounded like he might have been a pretty good dude, and that was what I could find. So there you go. Similarly, I could not find anything on Shelley Rudderman. I'm assuming maybe it was Sheldon Rudderman, but I tried all different combinations, all different kinds of spellings. I couldn't find anything.
Mm-hmm.
I did find some information on Dr. Charles Garfield.
Mm-hmm.
You and I texted you because I found some photos and I was like, Tori, I think this is the same dude. And then I found some better photos that guaranteed it was the same dude.
Yeah, like, it does look older. Like him.
Mm-hmm. And then when I read the guy's history, I was like, it's dead on. Like, he was in the right places, he was doing the right thing, everything. So I actually emailed him because his email address is out there. If you look in the show notes and click on some of the stuff about him, you'll see his email address. I emailed them like 2 days before we were recording this, so I didn't get a mm-hmm. reply. I don't know if I will. If I do, we might have a special episode.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
I just asked him if that was him, and if it was, I just kind of asked him a general question about what it was like to be, like, during the filming process. Like, you know, how did they contact you? What was it like? What did they do? That kind of thing. So, yeah, I didn't find anything bad about him. He started a foundation called the Shante Project in 1974 while he was at the University of San Francisco Cancer Institute. And it's like a volunteer organization to provide people with support who are facing life-threatening illnesses. So it kind of is what he was doing here, talking about how, you know, people have, you know, can be angry. They don't have, like, you know, it'd be hard to have a good attitude if you found out you were dying, honestly.
Yeah,
you know,
I gotta say,
it
like,
would be difficult.
My grandpa, my grandfather, when I was, God, how old was I? 9? I was pretty young when he was diagnosed with leukemia. And when he got to the end stages, he was furious. Like, he was really angry. And he even said some pretty nasty things to my grandma, which I think just came straight out of just being, like, so bitter about dying.
Yeah.
And I think that's...
Well, and you have no
even
control.
As a kid, I was like, that's so understandable to me, though. And I relate to that so hard because, like, it's how frustrating and terrifying is that? Like, I really get it. So, yeah, I imagine that's a really hard thing to counsel people through because there's nothing you can do and it just sucks. And that is what it is. So,
yeah. And Shante dealt a lot with cancer patients, but then because they were centered in San Francisco, they became one of the first community-based organizations to help people with HIV and AIDS during the epidemic in the 80s and everything.
Oh, nice.
And then, you know, they keep going. They've expanded for, you know, breast cancer, for all different kinds of cancer, focus on women, helping women, because a lot of times women, which may have been what happened with the person in this episode. Maybe they possibly may have been abandoned by their husband when, if you know, they found out they were going to die. That does happen, unfortunately.
It does, yeah. And or even so, just getting sick, even if there's a chance of recovery. Sometimes relationships don't last through that.
They have a partnership with PAWS. Pets are wonderful support. Aww. Both to make sure that people have, like, you know, can have their animals with them while they're at the end of their life.
Oh,
but then
good.
Also make sure their pets are taken care of when they leave.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he sounds like a really good dude.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't dealt deep into, like, this, but it sounds like they're not doing any, if nothing else, they're not doing harm.
Right.
And I don't see where they're not. He has, like, gotten, like, some big awards, like nationally recognized awards for this project and stuff he's worked on. So I have nothing bad to say about the dude. I mean, he was on In Search Of, and he didn't really have a big part in the episode.
No.
And honestly, both he and Shelley Rudderman, one of the things that I was concerned about when that part of the story first started was that it was going to be about, like, you just got to have, like, the right mindset to beat, you know, your cancer or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But what I liked about it was they weren't, don't listen to doctors. It was all like, this complements what is happening.
Yes.
Like, yeah. It wasn't like, don't go to the doctor because they're all liars. Like, you just got to have the right attitude and this kind of stuff. It was like, you know, you can't put all your faith in medicine. You have to do some work on your own, which I don't think that's harmful. So.
No, I mean, it's just as long as it's supporting other treatment, I think that's great.
Yeah. So good job, Dr. Charles Garfield.
Yay.
Yeah. I'm sad I didn't get to hear from him, but hey, maybe I will.
So yeah, that'd be cool.
So, yeah. He's also working at a place called the Star King for Ministry, which I think is a ministry college from what I've been able to look at. So there's a link for that in the show notes too. Some of his more recent speeches that I've seen on YouTube are for that. So he has kind of got like a little bit of a religious bent to him. But I mean, you know, religion doesn't have to be a negative. It can, if it helps people, it helps people. Like, I don't believe in it, but I don't think that people shouldn't believe in it if it helps them.
So. Yeah, no, I'm on the same page. Like, I wish I could believe in it sometimes, but I don't. But I understand why people do. And I think if it's helping you and not harming you in any way, then good.
Yeah, I'm not going to remove someone's comfort as long as it's not harming them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So I'm really fascinated by the science of just like near-death experiences. So I was looking up articles about that. And I found an article called What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About the Brain. And that's the one that does kind of mention that some of these experiences are not good. They don't go into detail, but I did think that was good that they point that out, because I feel like everyone always talks about near-death experiences as this beautiful, white, happy grandma's there, you know, and it's just like sometimes that's not the case. And yeah, but they had this really good quote about what happens in the brain when it's dying. And so I just thought I'd read that real quick. Like a town that loses power one neighborhood at a time, local regions of the brain go offline one after another. The mind, whose substrate is whichever neurons remain capable of generating electrical activity, does what it always does. It tells a story shaped by the person's experience, memory, and cultural expectations. Given these power outages, this experience may produce the rather strange and idiosyncratic stories that make up the corpus of near-death experience reports. To the person undergoing it, the near-death experience is as real as anything the mind produces during normal waking. So it feels real because your brain is producing all this stuff and having all these like reactions as the electricity goes off, but it is not actually real, probably.
Well, it's kind of like if you've ever had a dream that when you're done with the dream, like, because I've had several dreams that seem totally normal. When I
wake
up,
oh yeah,
you were like, oh shit, that was not something that actually happened. That was like, because like, it's not like, you know, you're not like in your underwear flying or anything. It's just like, you're just going through the course of life and you're talking to people and things happen. And then you wake up and you're like, what the fuck? Like, that was a dream? Like, yeah. So
yeah, or you wake up and you're like mad at somebody for something they did in your dream, and it's like,
really, yeah. Both my wife and I have each woken up and been like, did we just talk about da 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 before we went to bed? And be like, no. So yeah.
And then I was looking for examples of near-death experiences because I am kind of fascinated by these stories. Everyone knows about that kid who had the near-death experience and his parents like capitalized on it and made this whole like media empire with his little stories and stuff. And there are definitely...
What are you talking about?
Some kid who had like a near-death experience, and I think like... I can't remember what I think the book is called Heaven is Real or something.
Oh, is it the kid who like... Did he fall on ice?
I don't remember how he got to that point because I don't know a lot about it. I just remember like,
okay, because
they made a movie about it.
I saw a trailer, I think, when I was watching either like Endgame or Ragnarok about a movie. It was like, wow, they're putting Hallmark TV movies in the theaters now. Okay. Mm-hmm. It was like super religious.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it was like, I think he fell through ice. And so like he was, you know, comatose, like he was dead for a while, but because he was super cold, that kind of thing. I don't know if that's the same one or not, but
maybe. I don't know, but yeah, that's a really popular one. And then I found the story of Pam Reynolds. So Pam Reynolds is also one that gets cited in journals a lot by people who are talking about near-death experiences. And her story is kind of as follows. I've condensed it. I'll try to condense it more because I kind of read a lot. And I'll link to the place where I got the story as well in the show notes, so you can read the whole thing.
Oh, you'll link to it.
Okay. I'm sorry. Nick will link to it in the show notes when he does the show notes, because Nick does those. I just throw things in the Google Doc and let him sort it all out.
Yeah, I have to reformat it.
Just to try and reformat my mess, because I copy it in and I can't control V and it doesn't work, or control shift V.
You have to shift control V and then it puts it in the right format.
I tried to do that. It didn't work. I don't know. My Google Docs has weird formatting I need to get rid of because it's causing me problems. Anyway, Pam Reynolds was 35 in 1991, and she had this variety of symptoms, including dizziness and loss of speech. So eventually she has a CT scan that reveals a massive aneurysm at the base of her brain. And she was referred to Dr. Speltzer in Phoenix, Arizona, because he had pioneered this surgical procedure called hypothermic cardiac arrest, which would allow them to like stop her heart so they could remove the aneurysm, because otherwise it would be inoperable because of blood flow or something. I'm not a doctor, but that makes sense to me. Basically, it involves cooling the patient's body to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, stopping the heart and breathing, and then they drain all the blood from the brain. So pretty intense procedure. And as the anesthesia took effect, she heard this musical tone that, quote, seemed to pull her out of the top of her head. She says the further from the body she got, the clearer the tone became. And then once she was above her body, she says her vision got super clear and she saw many things in the operating room that she didn't recognize. And this is later held up as proof that this experience was real, because she could describe the tools and the procedure with like perfect accuracy. Some people say that's debatable. She had this sensation of being pulled, but not against her will, up through a tunnel. And she said it was sort of like being on an elevator. I think maybe she meant escalator, but either way, you know, being pulled up. And she heard her grandmother calling, and then she moved into a very bright light. And eventually she was able to discern figures in the light, and she recognized several dead relatives. But they wouldn't let her go further, telling her that if she did, she would not be...
No. You understand?
They basically are like, if you go any further, you can't return to your body.
They're and all locked arms, making like a fence. No, none shall pass.
I mean, maybe. But she basically understood that she had to go back. And so she got back to the operating room and she looked at her body and she didn't want to go back in. She thought that her body looked like a train wreck. And then
they took all the blood out of your body and they've been working on it for a while. It probably didn't look great.
No, probably doesn't. Yeah. But then she felt her uncle push her. People have to be pushed.
He's behind her. Get in there.
In it. And so she dove back into her body and she says that it hurt. That it felt like diving into a pool of ice water.
This sounds like a comedy. This sounds like a freaking comedy. Like, you can see the visuals of, like, the ghost uncle, like, get in there. And she's like, whoa, and she falls in the body and then...
dives in like a... yeah. And then after her experience, she lost all fear of death. She said in an MSNBC news broadcast, if death is the worst thing that happens to us, what an incredible thing. If at the end of our lives, this is what's going to happen to everyone, I don't see the problem. I really don't get it. I fear pain, but I don't fear death.
So now she fights crime.
That'd be cool. She did recover from the procedure. She lived until 2010 when she ended up dying of heart failure at the age of 53, probably unrelated. Her story was featured on Coast to Coast with Art Bell, which we all know is a super reliable source. He interviewed her. I think the episode was super long. My grandma used to listen to Art Bell. She was obsessed.
Yeah, he died too, because now George Neary, I think, is the host of Coast to Coast.
Yeah. So despite people citing her knowledge and descriptions of the procedure as evidence that she had to have been above her body and able to see everything, skeptics point out that she probably guessed what like a bone saw looked like, based on experience with dental tools.
I mean, she doesn't know actually... an escalator and an elevator. I'm not sure how much trust her judgment on what the tools yeah. in the operating room were.
And people also say she probably just heard them talking about the procedure and was able to like list things. Although some people argued that her ears were covered with gauze, so she wouldn't have heard anything, which I guess depends on how much gauze. I don't know. Anyway, it's just I thought it was kind of an interesting story. So that is Pam Reynolds' near-death experience.
I like a lot of the touchbacks of like, no, go back. It's cool.
People are always just pushing you away from the afterlife. They're like, don't die. And that makes me wonder if there's a reason for that. Like, maybe it's not that good there. Maybe they're like, no, don't, just wait. You're good.
They're like, we've been having a good time without you here. I don't want to say anything bad about you, but you should maybe just go back to your body, okay?
Just push them on in. Push them on back. Oh, dear. Anyway, yep. Near death experiences.
I also feel bad. I just want to make a correction. It's shift command V, not control V. So that might be part of the problem you're having, Tori.
I know. I use a Windows computer for work, and then I have a MacBook. So, like, I just get confused.
Okay. You say so.
Yeah.
As someone who does the same thing, it's the same buttons on both if you're using Google Docs.
It's true. It's true. But I do have a control on the MacBook. There is also a control button. So
there is a control button, things. But don't use it.
Yeah, I don't.
Use the command button. So
you just want me to stop messing up our notes with my fun formatting and big fonts because I'm old and I can't read small fonts anymore. I'm inching ever closer to death every freaking second.
I mean,
it's
you
can
make it show at a higher resolution. There's a little tab there. I usually, when we're doing the show, I usually have it like at 150 to make it easy for my old man eyes to read the notes. So anyway, that's near. I still then the whole life after, this was not an episode about life after death.
No.
This was at best an episode about near-death experiences, which is a different thing because near-death is not life after death.
It's true.
So, yeah. And then also, I think there was just some conflation of like OBEs and NDEs. Although mm-hmm. I like Laddies. That's a really nice.
I like that too. I feel like that should catch on.
I mean, LADEs, that's garbage. Don't say that. But Laddies, that's fun. So.
Yeah. Sounds OBEs like a dog. OBEs
and Laddies. So. And they're both kind of UK because, like, I think OBE is one of the things that, like, not anymore, but like King Charles could give you. I think it's one of the things. So Queen Elizabeth's not doing that anymore. So.
Oh, Thursday was so weird. Anyway, it was funny because, like, I had a friend who was messaging me and she's like, have you seen the interview with the vampire trailer? And I was like, no. And she's like, you have to watch it now. Also, the Queen died. And I was like, like, I'm trying to work.
That's what killed her. She watched it and was like, oh, fuck. Oh.
She was like, you know what? I'm good. I can peace out now. No, it was just funny because I was just like two big things at once. And then I was just like, I'm supposed to be working. And I'm like over here on the internet trying to like catch up on all this stuff. And I don't know. It was funny.
So I am about to get a bunch of, well, actually, I won't because we don't have the main listeners. But I was going to say I was about to get a bunch of hate email. Anne Rice died, right? She's dead.
She is dead. Yeah, she did pass away.
So all this stuff now is like her estate, her son, and all that kind of stuff.
Actually, I don't think Chris has anything to do with the show. He's been very.
Oh, well, then who's in charge? Who has the rights to all that stuff?
AMC.
AMC owns the rights to Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles?
Yes, at the moment.
They own the rights.
Somebody, well, they don't own the rights, obviously, but they have.
Right, but you have
they have
to,
leased
like, have
the
to,
rights.
Right, so someone to had make the to show. Give them permission to
do
it.
Yeah. Her estate did, and I'm sure Christopher did give permission. I don't know the details, so I don't know why we're talking about this. But I just know that he had originally this. Oh, we don't need to talk about this. But this has been my life for the last 3 days. It has literally derailed my life. This stupid fucking show, which is going to be, I think it's actually going to be good. And I'm still mad about parts of it. So I'm very all over the place.
I know. You told me what you're really mad about.
Just mad. Anyway, it's fine. I'm not happy about it. There's no point in having him be an established journalist. It doesn't make any sense. He could have just been a freelancer in modern times. It's fine. But anyway, that's not the way they chose to go.
He could have been a blogger. He could have just rung someone up and said, hey, I would like to talk to you. And then they answered.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how that whole interaction goes. But basically, they had been shopping the show around for years and it went to different people. And I know that Christopher Rice wrote a script. I have not read that script. I know that I think what's his name, the guy who directed Pushing Daisies and like Dead Like Me and stuff, was originally going to do part of it, but it just things just kept falling through. And so eventually the rights got signed over. I believe Anne was still alive when the rights were signed over, but I don't actually, I'd have to look at the timeline. So I'm not 100% on that. So anyway, yeah, but they changed the whole timeline of the series. They've changed a lot of stuff. So we'll just kind of ride the wave and see how it goes.
Yes. I used to get really angry about that kind of stuff because I was like, it exists in this form. Just let it exist in this form. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't have, like, if stupid people can't read, then fuck them. They don't need to see it on TV, right? Like, just it exists here, let it exist here. It doesn't need to be, you know, like when we, and same thing like with remaking movies. Just re-release the fucking original. You don't need to remake a super badass Japanese or Korean movie. Just release the Japanese or Korean movie. We don't need to have this bullshit. But I've kind of come to the point where if it's awful, I don't care because I'm not going to go see it. And there have been some recent examples. I mean, the MCU for one, and then also the Umbrella Academy and The Boys, where I think something like that as a reimagining actually can make things better because they can edit. Like something as huge as like the history of Marvel Comics or like, you know, 80 years of Batman. Mm-hmm. Okay, DC movies suck. Well, not to use them as a good example. But like you can go in there and just tighten things up and like grab ideas from different periods that worked and put them together and make them make sense. You know, the MCU is a much more cohesive story than any comic book you're going to go pick up and read because they're always rebooting like every freaking year.
Yeah, exactly.
Trying to do shit, right?
And I think the thing to remember is like the original stuff is still there. It's just a different take on it. And as long as, and it can be interesting to see like, okay, well, how are they going to do this? How are they going to take this character and work them in now that they've screwed this timeline or they've done this and changed this, which changes that, you know, and it's just interesting to see how it'll play out. So we will find out.
Yeah, I mean, like when The Boys came out, I saw the first, I haven't seen both the Boys and The Umbrella Academy. I have not watched anything past the first season, so I can't talk about secondary seasons. Mm-hmm. But like I originally had read the Umbrella Academy books and I had never read The Boys comic. And so when The Boys came out, I tried to read the comic and it is garbage. I'm sorry. Like that, it needed an editor. And that's what the TV show is. It's an editor on the writer, Garth Ennis. And like The Umbrella Academy, the dude went a little too crazy. And so the same thing, they kind of like, you know, they kind of just finessed it and made it more cohesive. And so,
yeah. You know, and it just offers a different perspective and that's cool. So yeah, I don't know how we got on this topic now. I don't even remember what we were talking about. King Charles.
Okay. Yeah.
Wow.
Because OBEs got the King's Charles, and you talk about how it was a crazy week, and it was kind of crazy because off of the Vampire Chronicles, and then, yeah. But and that's kind of something I learned from, although it took me a long time to maybe incorporate it in my head, I learned it from anime, because, like, you would get, like, you know, like, especially, like, the Tenchi Muyo series. Like, it has, like, you know, there's Tenchi Muyo in Love, and then there's the Tenchi Universe, and then there's the OVAs, the movies, and then there was Tenchi in Tokyo. And it's just, like, it's all the same characters, but, like, it's different iterations. And so you just, like, oh, that's just a different version of these. And, you know, they're good. And then you're, like, oh, that I like this version, and I also like this version, even though they're kind of different. It's, like, they can exist. It's fine. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So who knows? Maybe the Vampire Chronicles won't.
Honestly, at this point, I have come just having watched the trailer and just flailed with some friends. Like, I'm like, you know what? Some of this looks pretty freaking solid. And Sam Reed looks amazing and he understands the assignment. He's the one playing Lestat. So I think that if nothing else, like that is going to be good. And it seems like there's at least going to be some fun stuff that comes out of it, whatever happens.
Have you
like,
seen,
even if it's a train wreck,
who's playing Louis?
Yeah, I don't remember the guy's name, but I have seen him. Yes. Because he's like, also in the trailer.
I think, so I don't know.
Well, his personality, so they cast a black man for the role, which is fine. Oh. But they also, his personality seems a lot sassier, which is interesting. It'll just be interesting to see how it goes, because it seems like they're definitely changing some stuff up. So, yeah.
I could see that. I mean, one, having a black person would kind of make sense considering where his origin takes place.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
So
yeah.
The sassiness, though, considering when he became a vampire, is a little iffy because.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't use the word sassy.
A black man who's sassy in New Orleans at that time would not.
That's on me. I shouldn't have used the word sassy. I was actually thinking, because I was thinking that they made Daniel kind of sassy too. And he's kind of, I mean, he's sarcastic and stuff, but like in the first book. Yeah, I think that quippy is a better word. I feel like the writing is going to be very quippy. Because it feels like a lot of the characters just have this very like, here's my one liner, and so we'll see.
That could be bad.
I mean, it could be fine, and some of these characters are sort of like that, so that's okay. But like,
although
it's
I
just,
could
we'll see
how it goes. It would be interesting to see. I mean, maybe I'm writing some fanfic here for a series I'm probably never going to watch, but it would be interesting as a black man who became a vampire at that time period in New Orleans.
Right? Well, it's not that time period. They moved it to like 1910. So they've changed like a bunch
well,
of stuff.
Well, still not great.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. Things are still not good. And I think part of why they moved
the
timeline,
makes him
honestly,
a vampire for much less time, too, at this point. Oh, yeah. Okay. But anyway, going back to what I didn't know and now do know, I mean, you can still do it. That could still work. Just the shorter time period.
It'll work. Like it'll years. We'll just
anyway.
Yeah.
But
I don't know how we got off on this topic. We don't need to
being,
keep talking about
being
this.
Someone who is an oppressed population and then gains power.
Mm-hmm.
That could make you sassy. So could also make you like evil. Also,
or just snarky and just a little more proactive maybe than he was because he's a pretty passive guy.
Yeah.
So maybe that's part of it.
Melancholic,
too. Like, yeah, this
one
guy
might
just
say.
Sits around.
So
this guy just sits around.
You almost might say that Louis is goth in a way. So
a little. And so I think maybe they were just let's make him a little more proactive
in his
own story.
Clothing choices and his behavior. Yes.
His clothing. Someone needs to dress that man and should not allow him to pick his own clothes.
I don't know. If
time.
I had I didn't even have that body when I had a good body because it's like the way he's described as being built. I would totally dress like that. Like the slender pants and the big flowy shirts. Fuck yeah, I'd dress like that if I could pull it off.
Yeah. So. Anyway, welcome to our interview with the vampire podcast that we apparently started on accident.
The one thing I could not get over with Louis in the book, because I prefer him to Lestat. I'm an interview with the vampire person as opposed to the other books, right? He's my character. I prefer him.
Gotcha.
But the hands in the pockets, I could not survive without putting my hands in my pockets.
Mm.
And that was one of the things that is commented on the books about how like modern people, they have their hands in their pockets all the time and he doesn't do that. And I was like, I don't know if I could handle that part. But anyway, speaking of vampire podcasts, from what I understand, there's going to be a special pilot episode.
We're going to try because we both have lots of feelings, as you can tell, because now we've talked about this for longer than we've talked about the In Search of episode.
Well, I'm not going to be on that episode. It's going to be you and your friend Shell.
So hopefully Vampires Ruin My Life should have an episode coming out the week of October 2nd. That's when the show airs. Yeah, that's our plan. Okay. So I will be talking about this in great detail, even more, because it is, again, ruining my life. Once more. So here we go again, I guess. Yay.
Yeah, and so that would be about a week and a day after this episode is supposed to come out. I think this episode is supposed to come out on September 24th.
Okay.
Which is a Saturday, and then the 2nd of October would be the following Sunday. So.
Yeah. So anyway, that was a huge tangent that we went off
on. If not, ignore that because it didn't come out. And this is not the podcast you're looking for. So.
Yeah.
Missed it.
It's all right.
We should probably go.
Yeah, we should probably stop talking. I don't know why we're still babbling. I'm sorry, guys. You guys are like, I came in for near death. Although, to be fair, vampires are life after death, so it fits.
True.
It fits the theme.
Yes.
We did it. All right.
Look at Tori bringing it around. Good job.
Let's go before I keep rambling, because I probably will.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I Want to Rewatch was hosted by Tori and Nick and recorded in collaboration with Black Cat and Orange Tuxedo Studios.
Episode production, design, and editing is by Lazy End Productions. Our music is Dark Science by David Hillowitz and The Truth Is What We Make of It by The Agrarians.
This is where you can find our X-Files episodes and most of our X-Files adjacent bonus episodes, which cover television and films that are, you guessed it, X-Files adjacent. If you like them, tell a friend. We'd be happy to have them join us.
Speaking of which, be sure to join us next time as we go in search of the Loch Ness Monster.
And together, we'll try to figure out if the truth is still out there.
The truth is what we make of it.
Mom's texting me to make sure I'm okay after I got my booster shot. I'll probably feel like ass tomorrow, but I'm fine now.
You should tell her your arm's all swelling up like in Akira, and like
it's turning into its own thing.
Yeah,
it's just becoming its own little monster arm. No, I'm fine. It just took like an hour and a half, and my appointment was like at 9:30, and I didn't leave till like 11. So
oh,
it's a long thing. It's okay.